You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a ruling against the Bureau of Land Management's use of commercial logging in southwestern Oregon, and a judge in Humboldt County who resigned after admitting to misconduct. I'm reporter Jane Vaughn.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public safety and healthcare reporter.
Justin, we're going to start off with you. You covered a pretty major decision about the BLM's actions in old growth forests here in southern Oregon. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so a judge decided that the BLM's use of logging in habitat of the threatened northern spotted owl was illegal. So five environmental groups had sued the BLM. There are some forestry terms that I'll try to not get bogged down in here, but that suit was over something called the Integrated Vegetation Management Program. And that's a program with a pretty important goal. It's to promote forest restoration and fire resilience. And it involved fuel treatment, prescribed burns, and thinning. This is important because these forests are at really high risk for wildfire. But the program also included commercial logging. And these environmental groups took issue with that commercial logging part, specifically logging in what's called late successional reserves, another forest term. Those are forests dedicated to preserving animals like the northern spotted owl. And the court basically said that this program violates the BLM's own resource management plan. That plan has protections for the owl.
Okay. So what are those protections that the BLM has in its management plan?
Even more forest terms. There's something called a 20-year standard, and that rule limits activity in these late successional reserve forests to actions like logging that don't delay habitat development for the owl by 20 years or more. So basically, if you thin or log these stands, it can't set back the possibility of the northern spotted owl to use it for nesting by 20 years or more. The BLM argued that standard didn't apply to these forests, and they were going to allow logging on, and the judge disagreed with them. Environmental groups claim the logging in those areas reduced the forest canopy of old growth trees, and that forest canopy is really important for the owl.
Okay, so what does all of that mean now for the BLM projects in southern Oregon?
A spokesperson at the BLM that I talked to said that they're looking at the decision and they're still determining what their next steps will be. But it looks like the late Munger's timber sale, that's in Applegate Valley, is not allowed under this ruling. That was a pretty controversial logging project. I spoke with someone with one of the environmental groups, party to that lawsuit also, and he said the BLM can still do fuels treatments, prescribed burning, and thinning of small diameter trees. It was really this logging and late successional reserve that they took issue with. And so this court decision will now be sent to a district court for review before a final ruling.
Okay, great. Thanks, Justin. Roman, you went over to Medford City Hall earlier this week to talk with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and Medford Mayor Randy Sparacino about issues with recent changes to the U.S. Postal Service in Oregon. What are the Postal Service changes that have created mail delays and additional expenses?
Yeah, so essentially all the mail sent in Oregon will now first go to Portland to be processed before heading to its final destination, even if that final destination is your neighbor in Medford. There used to be these regional processing centers in Eugene and Medford that would also process outgoing mail, but those were downsized in February, so now they only handle incoming mail. There were also some additional changes, including the downsizing of local delivery routes, and this was all part of a national plan called Delivering for America, which is designed to make the USPS profitable because it is not profitable right now.
Okay. So how has this rerouting of mail affected residences and businesses?
Yeah, so according to postal workers and local business owners, delays in shipping packages has just become a lot more common. Medford Mayor Randy Sparacino said he talked to one construction business owner who said it took longer for a piece of mail to be sent to someone else in Medford than it took for mail to be sent across the country. I myself have also experienced some issues recently with receiving mail that has just somehow gotten lost. I don't know if it's actually related to this consolidation, but You know, that's a personal example. This national plan was set to downsize at least 50 other facilities across the country, but we did hear earlier this week from the Postmaster General that further consolidation efforts will be paused through the end of the year, and that was after outcry from U.S. senators, including both Oregon senators.
Okay. So there were some reports of confusion about how ballots were distributed in the recent primary election here in Oregon. What happened there?
Yeah, there were a couple of issues with ballots, one of which was reported on earlier was an issue with USPS workers holding election ballots behind because of confusions about how they're counted and how the Secretary of State's office is charged for the postage, because if you send a ballot in the mail, you don't have to pay for postage for it. Something I heard also during the press conference this week that I also heard just before the election was that USPS management in some rural parts of the state were telling postal workers to separate out ballots from the regular mail, put them in their personal vehicles after hours, and drive them to a nearby drop box and put them there. This was something the USPS was specifically told not to do by the Secretary of State's office. But after a meeting between USPS and Secretary of State officials, it sounded like that issue was fixed. But, you know, it seems like these delays have at least affected some ballots. I heard from the president of the Southern Oregon Postal Workers Union this week, Jeremy Schilling. He told me about at least one ballot that they received at the Medford processing plant that was destined for Klamath Falls. They received it on Tuesday of this week, but it had a postmark on Election Day, which is required for the ballot to be counted, but all the mail destined for Klamath Falls had already gone out that day. So the ballot wouldn't arrive in Klamath Falls until the next day, Wednesday, and that is after the 7-day deadline that ballots have to return to the county clerk's office after the election.
So, as you said, if the postmaster has agreed to pause these consolidation efforts, why is Oregon still being affected?
Yeah, well, the Postmaster General did say that further consolidation efforts will be paused, not current ones. So places that have already undergone this process won't be reversed. We did hear more from the Postmaster General this week that at least 20 locations across the country will not be pausing these consolidation efforts since they're already ongoing. You know, Ron Wyden, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, and Medford Mayor Randy Sparacino have all said they want these changes reversed. They say that the USPS has made it hard on purpose by specifically taking out these machines that used to do the outbound processing. So it's not really as simple as just turning them back on. They would have to, like, get new machines. So we'll have to see what happens throughout the rest of this year as, you know, some of these other facilities continue to go through the change, but things are kind of paused.
Great. Thanks, Roman. Justin, turning back to you, you also covered new federal protections for the coastal martin. First off, what is a coastal martin?
Well, they're also called Humboldt martins or Pacific martins, and they're members of the weasel family. They're cat-sized, they're meat eaters, very shy, but very cute. We have a picture on our website from a story we did. And there's barely any left. There's only around 400 in these still living in these pockets of habitat that are in southern Oregon and northern California. They've lost around 93% of their historic home range over the years, and that's because they faced a lot of threats. They were popular to trap back in the day. That's now illegal, but in more modern times, they've been harmed by logging and wildfire and even cars, off-road vehicles. They were listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act way back in 2020.
Okay, so they were listed as threatened back in 2020, as you said, under the Endangered Species Act. Why are they now getting a critical habitat designation, and what does that designation even mean?
So first, a critical habitat designation means that federal projects in those areas need to take into account any harmful impacts to the martin. So it doesn't really apply to private or state property unless that involves a permit or funding from the federal government. And you're right, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took a while to designate this habitat. That actually prompted a lawsuit by the conservation group Center for Biological Diversity. And a court ultimately told the service to kind of get on with it. And this week, federal agencies designated over 1 million acres around southern Oregon and northern California as this critical habitat for the martin. Over 10,000 acres of that are in the Oregon Dunes National Recreation Area, and that's a popular place for off-road vehicle use, which some claim can harm the martin. Now the federal government will need to consider the martin when allowing that kind of use.
Okay, interesting. So were conservation groups happy with this decision?
Sort of. I spoke with someone at the Center for Biological Diversity. They were partying the suit, and she said they, of course, celebrated the decision, But she was disappointed at the size of the critical habitat designation. Basically, only habitat where the marten live now was included. And like I said, they're in these kind of fragmented islands that aren't connected with each other anymore. So she says she would have liked to see areas designated that could be a home for the marten in the future, because that's their goal, is to help the species grow and eventually these isolated communities connect with each other.
Okay, great. Thanks, Justin. Roman, turning back to you, you also brought us an update this week on an investigation into a Humboldt County Superior Court judge. We've been following that for a while, and that finally concluded this week. So tell us about who this judge is and what happened there.
Yeah, so this was Superior Court Judge Gregory Kreiss, though he's no longer a judge since he resigned earlier this week. So that's after an agreement with the California Commission on Judicial Performance. This has been a months-long investigation, like we talked about, into a lot of misconduct that he's done. As part of this agreement, he agreed to resign earlier this week. He also agreed to never work in the court system in California again. That includes being a judge or serving as a judicial officer. I'm not necessarily sure about being a lawyer in a case. It sounds like that's still allowed. And as part of this agreement, Kreiss also admitted to 17 counts of misconduct while in office. There were a number of additional counts that were part of the investigation but were not included in this final decision by the commission.
Wow, that's big. I remember him sort of pushing back when the initial counts of misconduct came out. So this final agreement with the Commission on Judicial Performance, he did admit to 17 of the counts of wrongdoing. What were those counts that he admitted to?
Yeah, so most of the counts were related to Kreiss failing to disclose personal relationships with lawyers or clients in trials he presided over. For example, he worked in the public defender's office before becoming a Superior Court judge, so obviously, that means he has quite a few connections with the other public defenders. There's a lot of cases in here that you can read where, you know, he had a close personal relationship with a public defender who then, you know, represented clients in cases that he presided over, and then he never mentioned that he had a relationship with them. Usually, that's a case where that should be disclosed, and he should usually recuse himself in those situations if someone doesn't like that. There were some examples where, you know, he would say that he did have a relationship and said, well, if someone doesn't like this, then I'll recuse myself. And someone did say they don't like it, and then he didn't recuse himself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, during a lot of those, he just failed to disclose those. And that's really important because these personal connections obviously can give the appearance of favoritism. And there are some examples when you read the cases where it looks like there could be some favoritism there.
Mm-hmm.
There were also a number of other counts of misconduct. These included acting inappropriately, having inappropriate language. He lied about past disciplinary actions from the Commission on Judicial Performance. He used his office for personal gain. He participated in a virtual debate in January for the election that he attended from his judges' chambers. He also filmed campaign videos in there, which is not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And he also groped someone without consent, which was another thing.
Mm-hmm. And he admitted to all of those?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So he also recently lost his reelection to his judge seat back in March, which is interesting. So how did that investigation play into this election, and who did he lose to?
Yeah, so this is an elected judge position. So obviously he was running for re-election amidst all of this, which I think was the really interesting part about this. I mean, we don't always report on cases of judicial misconduct, but because he was running for re-election at the same time, I think that's what made it really interesting. His opponent, April Van Dyke, was running against him. She moved to Humboldt County in 2019 and is a lawyer that specializes in representing people who can't afford lawyers. So she ran a really hard campaign against Kreiss and this misconduct, because I think that's what anyone would do running against someone who's doing that. And he lost by a very significant margin. It was around 60% of the votes went to April Van Dyke, 30% to Kreiss. But she's not going to take office until next January. In the interim, you know, so I mean, basically, Kreiss would have left office anyways at the end of the year, but, you know, he's just retiring earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the interim, the court said that other judges are going to take Kreiss's caseload through the rest of the year. Right now, the first person is Judge Kelly Neal, who'll be taking up that stuff.
Okay, great. Thanks, Roman. And one more note, fire season is beginning in southern Oregon starting tomorrow. That's according to the Oregon Department of Forestry, which protects almost 2 million acres in Jackson and Josephine counties. That means there's additional regulations to prevent wildfires as the summer begins. So there's prohibitions on debris pile burning, fireworks, tracer ammunition. There's also rules about campfires, smoking, and portable stoves in forest lands. Additional restrictions might come later in the summer as the weather gets hotter and drier. So heads up that fire season is beginning. And that will do it for this week's debrief. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. You can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.